this is Brentwood from Legion of Love. Just letting you know you can now hear some of our new released and unreleased tracks on our website, legionoflove.com. You can also purchase our EPs, Grey Matter Tunes and Matters of the Heart, as well as all of our singles, including Shine a Light and Love is the Answer, at most major download sites. And of course, you can hear them on BBS Radio, the number one internet radio network in the world. Peace and love.
BBSRadio.com. If it's not mainstream, it could be here. Information and knowledge bringing humanity closer.
Everybody, and welcome to another Spiritual Hollywood Hour. I'd like to thank Don Newsom and BBS Radio for giving us this fabulous platform for Spiritual Hollywood to raise consciousness through media. I'm Kate Romero, your host for Spiritual Hollywood, and tonight we have a wonderful guest, someone I'm very excited to bring on and introduce you to, who you probably are familiar with by now. He is Jeff Van Vonderen, one of the stars of the show on A&E called Intervention, which is on Friday nights at 10 p.m. And once you've seen the show, you will be hooked. So, and if you haven't seen the show, seek it out and take a look at it. You will not forget this. If you want to call up Jeff Van Vonderen's website so you can take a look at what he's up to, go to www.jeffvanvonderen, that's J-E-F-F, V as in Victor, A-N, V as in Victor, O-N, D as in dog, E-R-E-N.com, or you can also get there by intervention.com, which is I-N-N-E-R-V as in Victor, E-N-T-I-O-N.com. So go ahead and pull up that website and take a look at his face. He looks a little like Dr. Phil, a very handsome Dr. Phil. And I'm going to read a little bit from Jeff's bio for you. Jeff Van Vonderen is a highly sought-after speaker and consultant both nationally and internationally. For over 25 years, individuals, families, and organizations have benefited from his skills and understanding in the areas of addiction, family systems, and recovery. Jeff is one of the featured interventionists on the Arts and Entertainment Network documentary series about intervention. For more information about this series, visit the A&E Network website. And if you're considering Jeff's involvement in an intervention with your loved one, do not have them watch Intervention on A&E first. That would be bad. Jeff is the author of Good News for the Chemically In... Let me take two. He's the author of Good News for the Chemically Dependent and the book Families Where Grace Is In Place. Families Where Grace Is In Place. I'm okay. I'm wearing glasses and I don't need them, so I'm going to take them off. Oh, there it is. That's now in its 14th printing. That's Families Where Grace Is In Place is in its 14th printing. When God's People Let You Down is another book. Tired of Trying to Measure Up, which is a great book. I've read it. And that's now in its 22nd printing. And The Subtle Power of Spiritual Abuse, now in its 18th printing. Several magazines and journals have featured Jeff's work. He's appeared on Oprah Winfrey, Larry King, and The Today Show. And his work has been published in Arabic, Chinese, French, German, Hungarian, Indonesian, Korean, Portuguese, Slovakian, and Spanish. And much of his material is available in audio and video. Quite often people try with the best of intentions to help themselves or their loved ones through a problem or crisis, only to discover that the help is not helpful or even harmful, Jeff says. They find themselves supporting and helping to belong on the outside, the very thing they do not support on the inside. And he goes on to say that individuals and families become dysfunctional by accident, but they get well on purpose, and this is what he's about, helping them do that. So without further ado, I'd like to bring on the fabulous Jeff Van Vonderen. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, Kate.
Thanks for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you. I'm just trying to be the person my dad thinks I am.
Now, that's a really good aspiration. That's wonderful. So you just got into town from somewhere. Was that Pittsburgh?
Yes, I was in Pittsburgh doing an intervention for the show, and then we brought him to West Palm Beach, Florida last night. So he's in detox first and then treatment. You know, he needs a safe medical detox first before he goes to the treatment center. So he's all set.
That's wonderful. And how many of these do you do a month, do you think, on average, of interventions?
Probably four.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 4 months. Not all for the show. Maybe 20% of my interventions are actually for the show.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing about the show that's so great is that I don't do anything differently for the show than I would if I was just going. I mean, the show calls me up, and they're my clients, and they say, can you come to Pittsburgh? We have somebody there, and I go there, and I train the family. And then the next day we do the intervention, just like in my own interventions. Somebody calls me, and I go there, and I train the family, and we do the intervention. So, in fact, I don't really even care that much if they get a show. I mean, they're going to get one, but I just care that the person goes, and there happens to be cameras there. But that doesn't really bother me or affect me. And by the time I get there, they've all had cameras following them around for a week anyway, so it really doesn't bother them either.
Well, that's fantastic. Well, I happen to know all about that because I'm your manager and you're my client, and I know about all your interventions for A&E. So this.
Well, and also you were in one.
Yes, I absolutely was. That's how you and I met.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind just sharing with our viewers something about the law of attraction and how that all works, I think that would be kind of fun because this is a radio show called Spiritual Hollywood, and what you're up to is kind of along that line, and the way you and I met and the show, as it turns out, was a lot to do with the law of attraction, because I had a client who was a Christian and also the star of a television series, and he was an alcoholic. And I was getting calls from casting directors, producers, and just, you know, everybody about the behavior of this person on the set. And he had recently come to my office, picked me up, and blew a raspberry on my stomach, so I figured he was doing the same on the sets. And that was unusual behavior. And turns out that he was drinking.
I think you were hearing from his wife, too, weren't you?
Yes, and no, actually, she didn't call me because at that point she was still very codependent and enabled.
Okay. Right.
Because she didn't have the tools to cope with this. She just knew that something was very wrong. She didn't know what to do. So I called her after I got the calls from the casting people and producers, and I said, so what's going on? And she said, well, I guess I'm going to have to tell somebody, and I guess now's the time. So she told me about the drinking situation, and then I said, well, what are we going to do? We need to do something about this. And so we sought out a Christian interventionist, which you have you're a minister, aren't you?
Yes, I'm ordained. I've been through seminary. I have a degree there, and I am ordained.
Yes. And so we found you, and you came out from Minnesota, I believe. Is that correct? Or did you live here at the time?
No, I just moved here.
Ah.
And actually, she had found a treatment center that had a Christian component to it called Pacific Hills, and they recommended me.
Oh, that's how that happened. Okay, great.
Yeah.
Well, I'm so glad that it happened because you came, you trained us. That was very, very efficient, and, I mean, it was life-transforming for every person involved in that intervention, including myself, because you handle it so gently, so confidently, and, you know, other modes of helping a person who is an alcoholic where they're really, their body's dependent on alcohol, where it's coming out their pores, and their body's dependent on it, is the hardest kind of alcoholic to treat. Is that correct?
Well, it's the most dangerous, because the most dangerous withdrawal, if you're physically addicted like he was,
mm-hmm.
the most dangerous withdrawal is from alcohol, more dangerous than heroin. It might not hurt as much as withdrawing from an opiate. You know, that might hurt so much you jump out the window, but it's not the absence of the opiate that kills you, it's jumping out the window. But with alcohol, if you're physically addicted like he was, even just withdrawing from it would put him in imminent physical danger. So we had him lined up to go to detox. And,
mm-hmm.
and of course, you know, he was, I remember that he was hiding vodka in water bottles everywhere and bringing them everywhere with him. And
yes.
even after he went to treatment, she found all kinds of those bottles hidden in different places in their house. And
mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah,
and the morning of his intervention, he had taken a 10-year-old swimming before 9 o'clock in the morning and had already, you know, gotten a pretty good buzz by then.
Well, sure, because you know what? He was not drinking to party.
Right.
You know, some people go on Friday night, they drink to party. He was not drinking to party. He was drinking to not withdraw.
Uh-huh.
You know, to manage his
medicinal.
Withdrawal.
Because, yeah, medicinal.
You know, so now, Katie, if you can imagine all the people across the country that have a loved one who is an alcoholic, who, if that person keeps drinking, it could kill them. But if they stop drinking, it could kill them, too. And they're putting all kinds of pressure on this person to stop as if that's the solution. And all that does is put them in danger. So the sobriety part, getting sober, you know, going through detox, that's just the first part of the process. What we want for people is recovery. And recovery and sobriety are not the same thing. Sobriety is just not drinking, okay? But recovery is about quality of life, you know, regaining the quality of life that you have lost as a result of this problem and getting the tools to keep that going.
Right. And training the family to support that transformation in the addicted person when they do come out of detox and rehab, training the family on how to manage that and help that transformation stay in place is really, really key in the environment that the person comes from. Is that correct?
Well, yes, because, you see, the family system, I see this thing as a family system issue, not just the alcoholic. And so mm-hmm. the simplest way to put that would be, everybody who loves that person and is trying to help, good or bad, doesn't matter, right or wrong, doesn't matter. There's no bad guys here, including the addict. There's just everybody's doing what they know what to do, but it's not working, so we have to do something else, okay? But so the family basically has been trying to be the treatment center.
Yes.
And the person's not getting better. And so for years, you know, or decades even, I've seen, you know, when they look at what's going on with their loved one, in their heart, it's not okay. It hurts their heart, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And in their head, it's not okay. But the way it works on a day-to-day basis is, it is okay. And they're paying the bills, and they're rescuing them, and they're bailing them out, and they're making excuses, or they're ignoring things. So what has to happen is that the family needs to be, the way the system operates needs to be rearranged so that it only supports health and not unhealth.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, so the irony is that the family's health is their issue, and if they get well themselves, like the way I explain it to them is they need to get sober from their loved one just like their loved one needs to get sober from their drug of choice. If they do that, that's the best help they can be for the addict. But instead of doing that, they focus on the addict, and the addict becomes their mood-altering substance, and then they're on the same roller coaster as the addict is in terms of mood altering. So if the addict looks good and tries hard and is great and makes promises, they mood alter up. And if they're breaking promises and looking dangerous and, you know, whatever, they mood alter down, and they become as preoccupied with the addict as the addict is with their drug of choice.
Yes.
So they have to be, their health has to be their issue, and they need to get well. And what that does is it creates a system in which the addict's problem doesn't work anymore. And that's the best confrontation on the addiction.
Right.
And also the best support for recovery afterwards.
Yes, and what you do is you raise bottom by coming in and doing the intervention before the person ends up dying or worse or you know, killing somebody else as well, driving drunk or whatever it is. You raise the bottom by doing the intervention, by not letting them, you know, get to the point where they kill themselves or someone else.
Well, see, that's an interesting thing because most people, most family systems and friends and stuff like that, they keep dealing with the small picture of addiction. And the small picture is how to put out the latest fire that the addict has started, how to get past the latest crisis, how to smooth it over, how to, you know, rescue them, how to make sure that, you know, the latest bad thing goes away. But the big picture of addiction is, you know, somebody starts using when they're 12 or 13, experimenting, or, you know, when they're 30 years old, they start using Vicodin differently than the dentist told them to.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of that is jail, or they run somebody over, or they kill themselves, or they ruin their body, or, mm-hmm. you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, an intervention has happened anyway. So there's an intervention going to come anyway.
Right.
But when that intervention happens, we don't have very much to say anymore. You know, death has the final say, or the judge has the final say, or whatever. Or they don't care what we have to say anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to raise bottom, because if you look at bottom is like if you had a rubber ball and you bounced it off the floor. Bottom is where it can't go any lower and it starts going the other direction. But when you're in prison or you're dead, you don't get a very good bounce.
No, you don't.
No, so we want to raise bottom and have them hit it now, because now they can get a really good bounce.
Yes, and
that's what recovery is, and that's about quality of life, and that's about they still care what we have to say. You know, they might be acting like they don't care what we have to say, but they still do.
Mm-hmm.
And so we want to raise bottom, and so yeah, the person needs to hit bottom, but right now we still have something to say about what that looks like.
Exactly, and to keep it from being devastating to a degree that you can't get it back. So just to go full circle with how, you know, the intervention that you and I met was taking place, we all sat in front of the windows and doors, and the person came home looking very, very shocked. There were no cameras in the room because this was way before your show.
Oh, yeah.
The only intervention that I had ever been in, and we each one wrote a letter from our heart to the addicted person saying, this is what your addiction is making me feel. This is what I expect from you if you want to stay in my life. And just very honest, and each one of us read our letter to the addicted person. And I was just so surprised that we had to sit in front of the windows and doors, because I guess people do try to jump out the window or run.
Oh, yeah. Oh, sure they do. But, you know, out of all the interventions I've done, I've only had two people who actually left that we couldn't get them back again.
I think I saw an episode of that.
Yeah. I mean, the other ones we get back. You know, we strategize ahead of time what happens if they do leave, who's going to go get them, and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
One of the people that left that was not able, that we weren't able to get back, was like a 17-year-old guy who basically went in his bedroom, locked the door, climbed in the out the window, ran out in the woods, and outwaited everybody.
Yeah.
So pretty soon people said, well, it stinks, you know, we're going home. And then after everybody left, he came back.
Right.
And then the other person was somebody who was so affluent and had their own resources that basically there wasn't anything anybody could take away from them, because they could fund the whole addiction themselves, and they said nothing to you, and they left. But the truth is, Katie, most addicts, if it was just up to them all alone, don't even have the resources in and of themselves to be an addict. Somebody's got to be supplying that somehow. Even if it's just paying their cell phone bill. Even if it's just, you know, giving them $10 here or gas money or whatever. See, that means that all the money that they get from the family for gas money, they get to use their other money for drugs.
Right.
You know.
Yes. So it's an enabling codependent situation where Al-Anon is a fairly good resource for people who are caught up in that, and they don't even know they don't know that they're caught up in that, and they don't understand that they're perpetuating the problem by giving the money to the addicted person or paying their cell phone bill or the rent or gas or whatever it is. So the best thing to do is stop paying those things. Is that right?
Well, yeah. You know, the question that we haven't been taught to ask is, you know, when you give somebody money or you pay their bill or whatever, the question that people need to ask is, am I helping something happen on the outside that I agree with on the inside?
Good point.
You know, if they would just ask that question, the answer is no, then they stop doing it, and then the addict's problem becomes their problem. But what happens is that they make the addict's problems their own, you know, the family's problem. Mm-hmm. The family makes them their problem. And so then the addict gets to have the problem, and they get to have all the pain and consequences of it.
Right.
When we do an intervention, you hand the addict their problem back. You give them back their problem and the pain and the consequences and an out. And that's treatment.
That's fabulous. That's fabulous. It's very, very effective. And so with the intervention with my client that that we were involved in, he was stunned, shocked, humiliated, couldn't get out of it, couldn't deny it. And as a Christian person, you know, it's not good to even admit you drink, let alone you're dependent on it. So
right.
There was a lot of shame and guilt in this person and a lot of denial. And, you know, finally that got penetrated to some degree, and he ended up finally going to treatment. But I know after the intervention that I said to you, I said, you really need to have your own show. This would save families and lives all over the world.
Well, of course, I remember you saying that, and I didn't even know what you were talking about.
I know. I'm just from Minnesota. Well, I don't know nothing about birth and no Hollywood baby. And
no.
I was like, that's okay. Don't you worry about it, because if it's meant to come, it will come. And it did come just by a series of happy accidents, and I don't believe in those, but synchronicities. And now you're in your fourth season of intervention.
Yeah.
And recently won a second PRISM Award, which is the Art of Making a Difference. And last year, I was with you, 2006, to win the Presidential PRISM Award, which is not just the Art of Making a Difference, but the Art of Leaving a Legacy. So congratulations, that you've come a long way. And there is a lot of law of attraction in this, because the declaration was made 5 years ago, you need your own show.
Well, yeah, and, you know, I didn't disagree with you. I just didn't know what you were talking about. I remember what I said. I said, okay, well, that's great.
It was so cute because you was like, I'm a civilian. I don't know about that.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
I just do interventions.
Exactly, and that's what it was supposed to be on TV. So it found a way to have you do that. The universe did. It just came and got you. And you said yes, and that's a fabulous thing. And I know absolutely with every fiber of my being that the most important thing to you in your heart of hearts is making a difference in the people's lives that you treat, not being on TV. I understand.
Oh, absolutely. You know, this intervention we just did in Pittsburgh, the guy, I had the guy's brother read his letter first, because after we went over the letters ahead of time, you know, it became obvious to me that he was the least shaming, and he was the most grieving the loss of his brother, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a very tender letter. And he read his letter, and the guy said, okay, I'll go right away. I mean, there's no hesitation. He said, oh, wow, okay, I feel like I won the lottery. I mean, he was very happy. But then after that, you know, I went to the producer of the show, and I said, well, it was a great intervention, but lousy show, huh?
That's funny.
Because I want them all to go that way, you know, and they don't, Katie. I mean, that one lasted 10 minutes, and I've done them where they last 11 and a half hours. That's the longest one I ever did. But, I mean, who cares as long as the person goes?
Exactly. And then when you were on Larry King, I was there with you as well, and you had a lot of wonderful testimonials from the people who did go to treatment and who were the subjects of the interventions, and they've turned their lives around and decided to go into some sort of healing arts themselves, where they are helping people who had their situation to overcome. And so this is saving lives and families all over the world, and it's, I know for most people that I speak to, it's one of their favorite shows. It's just filled with such humanity that you just can't look away. And
I guess it's a reality television show, but it's really not
right.
like reality television.
Yeah, not standard.
Well, you know, I mean, on Thursday, we're going to find out if we're nominated for an Emmy, okay?
Right.
Yeah, but we're in the reality television category.
Yes.
So, well, see, the difference between our show, we don't really have a category.
Right.
Because the difference is that in our show, there's no actors, there's no scripting, there's no hidden cameras. You just see what the camera saw,
mm-hmm.
okay? But in so many reality television shows, it's real people in situations they wouldn't normally be in, doing things they wouldn't normally do, in places they wouldn't normally go to.
Right.
And that's called reality television, and we're in that category. So, I mean, I don't know how anybody decides anything about that, but once again, it's, you know, I'm just feeling like it's my 15 minutes of fame, and I'm enjoying it. And plus, people are getting help in the meantime, which is even better. So
absolutely. And, you know, you're still writing your books, and you're still doing your talks and your TV shows and radio shows, and you've been doing some town hall meetings, which are wonderful. And why don't you tell our listeners something about that?
Well, now, see, for the show, there's a production company that I guess the best way to describe it would be that it's subcontracted by A&E to produce the show.
Uh-huh.
Okay? But for the town hall meetings, that's actually A&E, and then the Partnership for Drug Free America, and then whatever local cable company is in that area. So in Houston, it's one, and in Philadelphia, it's a different one. And what that is they do a town hall meeting, and they have a panel. I'm on the panel, and, you know, several local experts, and then there's a moderator, and then there's a big auditorium full of people, and they film this. So they ask us questions, we answer them, and then they open it up to the audience, and then they ask questions, too. And those questions are less about intervention and less about addiction and more about, like, well, my uncle's doing such and such, what do we do? You know, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's pretty cool. And I've done about, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 of those.
Mm-hmm.
And I really like doing that.
Right.
Because then I get to, like, talk to a group of people, which is a different form for me. But, I mean, it's something I have done and like to do, so.
Yeah.
It's great. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah. And we for a time there, went with the production company to many, many pitch meetings to, have the Jeff Van Vonderen show, which was very exciting. And I just know that, you know, intervention is the springboard for so much good in the world that it could turn into any kind of wonderful, venue that you could imagine, and just keep growing and growing and growing as there's a need called forth for what it is that you offer. So,
yeah.
You know, this is, I don't believe a 15 minutes of fame. I believe that it has no limits whatsoever. As long as you keep saying yes, I believe it's going to keep growing. And, GRB Entertainment, Gary Benz is just really a very benevolent person and has such gifts and talents, and the whole crew there, your crew are amazing.
They are amazing.
For intervention. Just everybody on the crew, all the people involved, everybody at the office, all of the people, you know, their heart's really in it. It's exciting. There's a lot of adrenaline. There's a lot of, you know, white knuckles sometimes, and sometimes things don't always go right, but you guys still manage to work it out, and you're a big family, and
Well, you know, we've done about 70 interventions for the show now. I think that's about right.
That's fabulous.
And 68 of the people went to treatment.
Now, that's so wonderful. Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yes, and you get to do this all the time. And like you said, you're only doing 20% of it for the intervention show, and the other 80% is what you do privately. So,
right.
So you're just out there just doing the, you know, you're a fantastic guardian angel. And I remember teasing you about how some other types of ways people can get help, you know, for addiction are like a fly swatter and you're a bazooka.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I remember that, too. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, you're a bazooka, most definitely. Because, you know, you're a tall, gentle giant who looks like you could say, it's okay, you don't have to go, but that's not an option when you're...
No, you know, what I think is, I think everybody's gone. Okay, when I start an intervention, I think everybody's gone.
Now, that's great visualization. That's
Yeah, and actually, I've come up with a picture. I came up with a picture to describe this, and now I use this as part of my description ahead of time when I'm training the family.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I look at it like we're all there, and there's this big boulder in the middle of the room. Okay, and inside of that boulder is, okay, I'll go to treatment. And my job is to chip away everything that isn't that. So the training is about chipping away everything on that boulder that is not, okay, I'll go, till we get to, okay, I'll go.
It's a great analogy. That's how I'm the statue of David inside a slab of marble.
Well, see, it feels like an art to me. Because
right.
everyone is different. Each one is different. The thing that's the same about every intervention, because there is something the same, is you have a person who's at point A, which they need help, don't think they do and won't get it, or they need help, say they do and won't get it, or they need help and keep getting help that doesn't help because they're in control of the plan, so they keep coming up with these goofy plans, you know, that never solve anything.
Yeah,
that's point A. Yeah, that's point A, and we just want to move it on to point B, which is needs help, and we'll get it. So we're not really there to do therapy on the person. We're not really there to figure out how this could have happened or why this happened or whatever. That's all therapy issues. That's not ours. Ours is point A to point B. But what's different is the addict and the family. That's different every time. So there, to me, it feels like that's why I came up with the Boulder thing, you know. And I think basically after that first day, everybody's going to treatment unless we screw up. You know what I mean? If we do what we planned and practiced and learned and everything else, they're gone. And pretty much that's how it is. About 90-95% of the people, the reason I say that is when I do my own interventions, 90% of the time the person says yes, and out of the 10% that say no, half of them end up going within a couple of days anyway.
That's awesome.
You know?
Fabulous.
And the statistics for the show are even higher.
That's fantastic. Truly.
So, I mean, what could be better? How cool is that?
It's so cool. I mean, it's like, I love the work. I love the work that I do, and I know you love the work that you do, and you love what you do. You do what you love, and that's what I want for everybody. We, Don Newsom of BBS Radio and Winfrey and a lot of other amazing, fabulous people and all the other radio hosts that have their platform on BBS Radio last night from 4:11 in the morning till 5:11 in the morning, and I know you were up because you sent me an email.
I was on the East Coast.
Yeah, and we did something called Fire the Grid, where for 1 hour we held the vibration of peace, of healing, of the end of global warming, the end of religious wars, the end, you name it, every single thing that we aspire to. In our world, we all globally, and I mean globally, there are millions of people involved in this all over the world at the same time for that 1 hour, and it was intoxicating. It was just the most amazing energetic shift took place, and I know that everyone who was involved had a transformation out of it just the same way that the world did. And I'm just going to take a little liberty here and read what it was my intentions for the world during that hour were. Fire the grid. My intention for the world is to end all wars, all poverty, all unrecognition of who we are, all global warming, all anger, pain, and suffering, all illness of thought. My intention for the planet is to calm all natural disasters, hatred between religions, that I, as a member of this Earth school, can and will become a great spiritual teacher and leader, and that all light workers will awaken to find their wings working perfectly and use them well and wisely, that we all know that we are one, one energy, one hope, one God, one love. We are healed, pure gratitude and harmony, global worldly love, one heart, one energy, one mind, and all fear is gone from each and every one of us, one by one, to come to know the God that we are within. And that was my thoughts for that hour last night. And when I went to bed, finally, I was so abuzz and vibrating that I couldn't go to sleep. It took me 2 hours to go to sleep. And when I did go to sleep, I shivered until about 10 o'clock this morning just from the vibration. So, you know, there is something incredible happened because love absolutely heals everything. And there was nothing but pure love last night from 4:11 to 5:11. And it was, I mean, 4 and 5 makes 9, 11. Wow, I just got that.
Oh.
Whoa. Whoa.
Well, you know my story about 9/11, don't you?
No.
Yeah, well, I had lunch at the World Trade Center.
You called me soon after that happened. What did you tell everyone?
Yeah, I had lunch at the World Trade Center on the 10th, on a whim.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was on the East Coast. I had been gone for 17 days, and I just did not feel like, I was in Philadelphia. I just did not feel like flying back to the West Coast. I thought, you know what, I'm going to go up to New York City and kick back for a couple days. And so I drove up there and checked into the Holiday Inn by the Newark Airport
mm-hmm.
on the 9th. And then the 10th, I thought, well, you know, I haven't had lunch at the World Trade Center for a while. So I drove down in there and I had lunch. And then the next morning I woke up and, you know, I checked my emails. And there's a picture of it, you know, how servers, they flash a news picture every 10 seconds, you know.
Huh?
And there's a picture of it burning, and I never pay attention to that stuff. And
uh-huh.
I didn't. I thought, okay, there's a building burning someplace. I mean, that's all I thought.
Uh-huh.
I got my emails, and then I turned on CNN, and there it was. And I was just looking at this thinking, what am I looking at? What is this? And it never occurred to me, Katie, to even look out the window. If I had looked out the window, I'd have seen the second plane hit. But, of course, I was like everybody else in the United States, glued to CNN, you know, so I'm watching this, but, you know, afterwards, you know, people said, well, were you lucky or were you fortunate or whatever, and those, what I felt like was, evidently there's more for me to do, because I could have had the whim the next day.
Yeah.
Well, I could have been there.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's a pretty significant thing for me, that whole thing.
Yeah, that's a near miss, most definitely. And you do have a lot of great work to do, Jeff, and you're doing it, and nothing's going to stop you. And, you know, I'm just so pleased to be even a tiny little part of it. And I have a question for you. Do you think, in your opinion, as an intervention specialist, that anger could be an addiction or domestic violence could be an addiction?
Well, yes, but because addiction... any addiction is a mood disorder. So, of course, when you're talking about anger, you're talking about mood.
Yes.
You know. And the thing about domestic violence is that there's a cycle that the domestic violence, the perpetrator of that, there's a cycle that the person goes on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And what's interesting about that and very telling about that is that, so... you know, if you look at it like a wave that goes up and down, okay, and at the top of the wave is where they act out. And after that, the wave starts going down because now they feel bad and they feel remorse and they're making promises and all kind of stuff and stuffing everything because they don't have the tools or the skills to deal with their feelings in a healthy way. You know, they build it all up. And when it hits the bottom of the wave, that's when it starts to build up to the acting out again. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, for the victim, they're on a wave too, but it's upside down from the perpetrator.
Right.
So in other words, when the perpetrator acts out, that's their high point. But that's the victim's low point.
Right.
Okay? And now they're making promises, and now they're trying hard, and they're holding everything in. When that's happening, the victim is going toward their high point. They're hopeful. They're, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So they're building to their high point, and then when the person gets to their low point, then they start saying things, or they start, giving nonverbal kind of signals that they're upset or whatever. And when that stuff happens, well, then the victim starts coming back down again, you know, because they're waiting for the shoe to drop.
Right.
So their waves are, you know, it's hard for me to explain this, you know, without a blackboard. But, I mean, if you put them together, it just looks like figure eights hooked up to each other.
Right.
You know, and that is a very addictive process. Very, very, you know, and for the victim, I mean, there's so much shame in being abused.
Yes, there is.
That they actually, it's like they get the message that they're not okay, and they're so not okay that this person can do this to them.
Right.
Okay. Well, if they believe that they're not okay, what's the best way for them to feel as not okay as they are? Keep getting abused. see.
Right.
So the system just feeds on itself over and over again.
Yeah, and that honeymoon period that happens after it is part of what keeps the people together and keeps the woman or the man from leaving.
Yes, because the victim during the honeymoon period, that's a downward spiral for the perpetrator, because they are stuffing everything. You know, they're holding everything in and trying to be a good guy.
Mm-hmm. Okay?
But all during that time is when the victim starts going up toward their high, because now they're feeling hopeful again and they're hearing all the right stuff and everything else. So, mm-hmm. So they kind of pass each other on the way up and on the way down, and then recycle again when they each get to their highs and lows.
Yeah, yeah. When you were telling me about how the perpetrator is, you know, reaching that point of where they're just about to lash out and physically abuse, it
yes.
reminds me of, have you ever heard of a rogue wave? Are you familiar
yes.
with them?
Yes.
Yeah. Rogue waves steal energy from the other waves around them, and they just happen out of nowhere, and they take down giant cruise ships and you name it, just take them right down. And so that's the image I got in my mind when you were describing that wave. That
all right. Well, let me explain it this way, okay? Because perpetrators don't feel good about what they're doing. They have shame too.
Right.
Okay. So let me do it this way. When a husband abuses his wife, now I am in the husband's head now, okay?
Uh huh.
When a husband abuses his wife, what does that say about the husband? Says bad husband.
Yes.
Well, how should the husband feel for being such a bad husband?
Ashamed.
Yeah, he should feel bad. Well, what's the best way for the bad husband to feel as bad as he should feel for being a bad husband?
Is to strike his wife.
Yeah, keep doing it again. So that's his trap. And when the wife gets abused, what does that say about her? Bad wife.
Yes.
Well, how should she feel for being such a bad wife?
Ashamed.
Yeah, what's the best way for her to feel as bad as she should feel for being such a bad wife? Get beat up again.
Yes, and not tell anybody.
Right, so that's the trap, that's the system that they get locked in. And you know, when you get, like, abuse where, like let's say sexual abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you see, and especially if somebody tells the victim, don't tell.
Right.
Well, by virtue of telling them, don't tell, they're also telling them that what they're doing to them must be bad, because that's the kind of stuff you don't tell about.
Yes.
Okay, so here's the message. What I'm doing to you is not okay. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And you are so not okay that I can do this not okay thing to you, and it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like a double shame. Not just the abuse itself, but also the message about the person who, you know, evidently has this coming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
right.
So there's a lot of traps in that kind of stuff. And if you don't have, and it's especially if the soil that you have in you from where you've come from, if it's fertile for those kinds of messages,
mm-hmm.
Well then it, you know, the plant that grows is just more abuse and more being abused and
right.
And,
right.
You know?
Have a predisposition for it in the first place because you grew up around it and it's generational. Then you're definitely going to attract that because it's familiar for one thing, and it's all you know, and you don't know a better way. So
well, and it's consistent with who you are, or not who you are, but who you've been taught you are.
Yes, who you've been told that you are.
Yeah.
And it's just you know, we have manuals when we get a new VCR or a new gadget of any kind. It comes with a guidebook and a manual that we should read. A lot of us don't read them. I'm one of them. I like to try to figure it out for myself, and then if I can't, then I resort to the manual, and I will eventually read it. But when it comes,
I hate reading manuals.
I hate it, and they're getting thicker all the time, aren't they? They're like a foot wide, those books.
I hate them.
I got one of those handheld email devices, a Trio, and the book is four times thicker than the little deal is. And it's like, it's daunting. You just don't want to look in there. But when it comes to relationships, we just throw ourselves together without any kind of manual or how-to guide or anything and just hope it all works out. And
well, no, I'll disagree with that, but not really. But what I want to say is we do have a manual, but it doesn't work.
Okay, what's the manual? Wedding vows?
No, the manual is how we've been wired up in the past.
Oh, okay. Well, there's one.
Yeah, we don't come neutral without a manual and wish we had a good one. We come with a manual that is full of unspoken rules that we got in our family. Okay, for instance, in my family, there was a rule that said adults are more important than children.
Mm-hmm.
But nobody ever said that. That was just an unspoken thing.
Right.
Okay, so we never sat down at dinner and my dad said, you know, okay, now in this family, adults are more important than kids.
Mm-hmm.
But the way it worked out is that was the message. And the only way that you found out that that rule was there, basically, was if you broke it.
Yes.
Which, of course, you broke it by accident all the time because you didn't know it was there.
Right.
That's the manual.
Got it.
And then you bring that into... into new relationships, and you try is too intentional of a word, okay? But you try to recreate relationship systems in which your old relationship skills work.
Mm-hmm.
They don't do that on purpose.
Right.
But the thing is, if you don't, when I was doing counseling and working in therapy with people,
mm-hmm.
one of the things I had them do was get very conscious about all the unspoken rules that govern their family system.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you become conscious about them, in other words, I'll go back to the one I just said, adults are more important than kids.
Right.
Okay, once I became conscious that that actually was a rule in my family, then I can decide if that's one I want to pass on to my next family. And if it isn't, I can break it on purpose. But if I don't break it on purpose, I will pass it on by accident.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree with that. And I also sense that, you know... And
we're having fun, aren't we?
I love this.
Yeah.
I also, I mean, anytime we get together, our conversations are like, it's like the time just flies by because it's like, this is my favorite subject, is human nature and figuring out what makes us all tick and how we can find a way to all get along. But I've also learned that until you love yourself, it really does not behoove you to get involved with anybody, because if you get married before you love yourself, you're going to end up hating both of you, as David Zasloff said in his comedy routine last weekend. But
all right. See, the way I would say that is you can't give away something you don't actually have.
True.
So, for instance, if I have a pen, I can give it to you, but I can't give you a pen I don't have.
Right, and you can only treat others as well as you treat yourself.
So, for instance, I remember one counseling session where, you know, this one, she was 16 and she was pregnant. She was trying to decide whether to keep the baby or abort the baby or give it up for adoption, you know, whatever.
Uh-huh.
And at the end of it, after hearing all the horror stories of her family system,
mm-hmm.
she said, well, I'm going to keep my baby. And I said, well, what's that about? Okay. And she said, because I'm going to give my baby what I never got. Well, see, Katie, you can't give something you never got. You can only give what you got.
Right.
And so she will unintentionally now pass on all the messages and all the whatever that she got with good intentions, but you can't give away what you never got.
Or that you don't have.
Yep.
Yes, that makes good sense. I would like to, at this time, Jeff, if it's okay with you, invite some callers to go ahead and call in and ask you anything that they want to. Toll-free, you can call in the USA, 877-876-5227. That's toll-free in the U.S. only, 877-876-5227. Toll-free for Canada only is 888-815-9756. And locally, the direct line, you can call 530-876-3222. Again, that's in the U.S., 877, toll-free, 877-876-5227. Canada only, 888-815-9756. And locally, direct line is 530-876-3222. Don't be bashful out there. If you have something in your heart that you want to ask Jeff, this is the time to ask him. We're coming up on the end of the Spiritual Hollywood Hour. It's 6:48 right now, and we complete at 6:55. So you do have a few minutes if you'd like to call in and ask Jeff anything. Until
yeah,
then, we're going to keep chatting. So
okay.
And if I offer you $20 if you call, then maybe you will. But nothing is too. There's no shame, blame, guilt, or make wrong whatsoever in these conversations, because we're all wanting to heal, and it's all about, you know, healing the planet one person at a time. And if you don't speak up, you're not going to get. So please feel free to call right up until a minute before we end, which I said was 6:55. And if you don't feel like calling, that's okay too. But just get help from somebody somewhere. Go to Jeff's website at intervention.com. That's INNERV as in Victor, ENTION.com. And if you can't speak about it here on the radio show, go to his website and email Jeff and get your help that way. But do speak up and do get help no matter what, because there is help for you here. So Jeff, what do you see for yourself happening in the next 5 years? Do you plan on retiring?
Oh, I'm glad you asked that, because I think I'm already retired.
I love it.
I used to know, I knew this 75-year-old Armenian minister. And there's two things he told me that really were significant to me. I mean, there's a lot of things, but two I'm going to tell you, okay? Because he was still, you know, working in a church, and the guy was 75 years old. I said, well, George, aren't you ever going to retire? And he said, retirement is when you stop doing what you don't want to do so you can start doing what you want to do, but I'm already doing what I want to do, so I guess I'm retired already.
That's awesome. I guess that's awesome too then.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
You've made your vocation your vacation.
Yeah. And then the other thing that he said was the key to talking to people, to teaching and, you know, speaking to people.
Mm-hmm.
Is if you can make them smile or laugh while you're doing it. Even in the middle. Well, you remember, you know, even in the intervention you were part of.
Uh-huh.
There were a lot of times you were kind of laughing at ourselves or you know, it was. Yeah.
It was a hard situation.
Yeah, it was very heavy, and yet people were smiling. Well, he said if you can make people smile, then you can hit them in the teeth without splitting their lips.
Now, that's clever.
And I remember that.
Yep.
He was a great guy. You know, and his mother was part of that whole thing with Turkey and Armenia back then.
Uh-huh.
I mean, so he had such pain in his life, and he was just came through that and was just a great guy.
Wonderful. Well, life experience can teach you or it can break you. And it all depends on what you do with it, because life comes at all of us, and it's what we do with it that matters most. And, you know, for people who don't have the skills, the communication skills, the tools, to turn their lives around, you know, listeners, please tell your friends and your neighbors and your family about Jeff's website, and that there is this help available. For the longest time, I'd never heard of such a thing until my client needed help, and we got him help, and it did help as far as I know. And
well, you know what's interesting about that is that really is the reason why. That is the bottom line reason why I said yes to the show.
Oh, I know.
Because I never had aspired to be on TV. You know, I didn't say I'm going to move to California and try to get on TV. I don't care about that. I moved to California because I travel for my work, so I can live anywhere I want, and I might as well be warm.
Well, that's a big thing.
That was my big strategy. You know,
don't you find it interesting that soon after you moved here, we sort of plucked you right out of, you know, whatever your options were.
Oh yeah. But see, the reason I said yes to the show, even though the whole time I was talking to them about doing the show, I was telling them this is never going to work, because none of the people that I worked with, I couldn't envision any of them wanting a camera following them around.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, can you imagine your client wanting a camera following him around, sneaking vodka out of water bottles? You know, but they pulled it off. But the reason I said yes is because half the time, at least half the time, when I was doing my own interventions, somebody would say what you just said. I didn't even know there was such a thing.
Right.
Or they'd say, you know what, if I had known about this 5 years ago, maybe my dad would still be alive. And I thought, well, that's not right, because there is such a thing as this.
Yes.
So I thought, what a great way to help people understand that there is and what it is, and that's what's happened.
Yes, well, the spiritual Hollywood is absolutely designed to raise consciousness using Hollywood, and that's what Spiritual Hollywood Radio Show is all about, and that's what my management company, Guardian Angel Management, is all about, and that's what I also have a life coaching company called Quantum Leap Life Coaching, which I also, one person at a time, you know, do my own kind of intervention on them to help remind them of who they are and bring them back to their divinity so that they can fly. Because a lot of people walk around and think that their wings are broken when they're really not. You can't really damage the innate self. You just can't. And it's in believing that you have that causes you to want to tune out your feelings and become addicted to something to keep you from being present and feeling who you really are. Because, you know, we're powerful beings, and that's a lot. That's confronting to be so powerful and to step into that. You know, it takes a lot of courage to really, really step into that and get help and to grow up. I mean, growing up is confronting, which is why a lot of people avoid it, and that's where addiction comes in. So,
well, you know, the thing that's kind of a common denominator, not kind of, it's a common denominator with addiction is that, and this is true of your clients if you think about it, is that if you went back before all this happened, before they started getting in trouble and, you know, going down the path of addiction, if you went back and you had a conversation with them and you predicted what the next 8 years or the next 10 years or the next year is going to look like and what their life is going to look like today, they themselves would not believe it.
Right, right.
That's, now, I mean, the family's looking at it, and they can't believe it, but the client wouldn't believe it, which means that they have been living inconsistent with their value system.
Yes.
But the difference is that if you do something, Katie, if you do something inconsistent with your value system, which you do because you're normal once in a while, okay, then you feel bad and you fix it.
Uh-huh.
Make amends, you know, make it right.
Right.
But what addicts do is they do something inconsistent with their value system. They feel bad. They medicate instead of fixing it, and then the hole gets deeper and deeper.
Yeah, and I just want to point out you said medicate, not meditate. So with that, I'm going to wrap up the Spiritual Hollywood Hour. Jeff, thank you so, so much for making yourself available for this absolutely invigorating conversation. I trust that the listeners got a lot out of it. I know I did.
And that was a blast. It was a blast.
Thank you so much. And we'll have to have lunch very soon. And I just want to introduce our next guest for next week is Ike Krieger of www.businesssuccessbuilders.com. Check that out next week. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, Don Newsom at BBS Radio. Thank you, Jeff. And I'd like everyone to take a deep breath, stand up really straight, and love yourselves. Good night, everyone.
Thanks.
Hi, this is singer-songwriter Robin Avery. It's a privilege to be on BBS Radio. You've been listening to music from my new release, The Way You Hold Me. Come visit me and check out the CD at robinavery.com.